Very few people understand an enigmatic book called Job. Job is a book that almost no one ever reads. I would say that most of you in this room have not turned to the book of Job and read it in the last several years. Very few people do. Very few people want to wade through all the laborious arguments. We're familiar with the first part of it, about what happened to Job, of how Satan the devil was there when the sons of God, who are the angels of God, obviously, came together to report to the Eternal in heaven above. And Satan also appeared among them. Now, when you read the beginning of the book of Job, you hear about all of his wealth and of all the great blessings that have been poured out upon him. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household. So he was a multimillionaire by any standard of measurement. His sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. It was so in the days that their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." So he was trying to cover for all of them. He was supposed to be a really righteous man. Verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God, and that obviously means angels, came to present themselves before the Eternal, and the adversary, is what the original Hebrew is, Satan, came also among them. And the Eternal said unto Satan, "Whence comest thou?" Then Satan answered the Eternal, "From going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it." Now let me give you something that I want to clear up that was falsely preached many years ago. It was falsely believed many years ago and taught to the worldwide church that Satan the devil broadcasts almost as if over the airwaves. The reasoning was that he is called the prince of the power of the air. And that a human being, when it first takes its first breath out of the womb, is in a sense getting a little bit of the nature of Satan the devil with that first breath, because Satan is everywhere. Like if you had a little handheld telephone, you could make a call sitting in your chair, couldn't you, inside this building? And so right this minute, our bodies are being bombarded with literally thousands, not hundreds, if you look at UHF and VHF and AM and FM and all of these various frequencies that are in the air, just thousands of them. And you could pick them up if you sat right here with one of those UHF radios, or one that could even pick up shortwave, and you could be listening to ships at sea inside this room. Now, having said that, you all are aware that these waves travel at different frequencies beyond the human range of hearing, and so they are not, we can't hear them. Well, the idea was that Satan the devil is virtually everywhere present, that he broadcasts his mind, his attitude. And therefore, if we're not careful, if we kind of tune into the devil, he's just right there. Well, what does that say about our sweet little babies that are born? The minute the little precious baby comes out of the womb and takes its first breath, it's got, what, a little bit of the devil's nature? Let me tell you, everywhere in the Bible, Satan the devil is at one place at one time. He is not omnipresent, as is God. God is capable of being everywhere present. The devil is not. Satan the devil is in one place at one time. And here's a scripture that helps to tell you that. Going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it. Satan was there at creation in the Garden of Eden personally. Satan was there at Job's assessment, or in heaven when they were talking about Job. He was there in person to enter into Judas Iscariot. He was there in person, of course, at the birth of Jesus Christ to influence Herod to try to have all the babies killed and therefore kill Christ. And he is not capable of broadcasting everywhere. The Eternal said unto Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that fears God and eschews or avoids, hates evil?" Then Satan answered the Eternal and said, "Does Job fear God for naught? Have not you made a protective barrier or hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? You bless the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." The devil didn't know Job very well. The devil was not capable of influencing Job. For the Eternal said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. only upon himself put not forth your head. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Eternal. Now, I won't read all of the rest of this, but this next chapter, next few verses, 2:22, everything he had was gone, wife and child dead, all of the cattle, the servants, everything has collapsed, terrible, terrible, horrible things. And then his body, later on, in chapter 2:5, touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you. The devil said, he's in your hand, I will do this, and so on, until God said, you've got to save his life. You can do everything short of killing him. So Satan, verse 7, went forth from the presence of the Eternal and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He's sitting there taking a piece of a potsherd, a piece of fractured vase or some old clay jug, to scrape the pus that is leaking out of these hideous sores. He's sitting in a pile of ashes, throwing ashes on his head, which was common in the Middle East for terrible disaster. And the following lengthy, almost unending series of arguments ensues. Now, I'm not going to read all of that, but I do want to skip ahead to the 22nd chapter of the book of Job. Job would belabor all that was wrong with him, but not once would he say anything against God. He would only extol God, how great God was, how much God knew, how everything was in God's hands. But the men who were sitting around him just knew that the man was horrible and something was terribly wrong with him. They didn't know exactly what it was. They were sure that he was a sinner and that he was trying to excuse himself, and he really was just trying to conceal his sins. Chapter 22, verse 1. Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, can a man be profitable unto God as he that is wise may be profitable unto himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you are righteous? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways perfect? Will he reprove you for fear of thee, or will he enter with thee into judgment? Is not your wickedness great, and your iniquities infinite? In other words, you're a horrible sinner. There is no end to your sin. For you have taken a pledge from your brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing. And of course, he had done no such thing. The man was assuming that Job had gotten wealthy over the plight of his neighbors and other people. You have not given water to the weary to drink, and you have withholden bread from the hungry. But as for the mighty man, he had the earth, and the honorable man dwelt in it. You have sent away widows empty, and the arms of the fatherless have been broken. Therefore snares are round about you, and sudden fear troubles you. It goes on and on and on about that. And finally, verse 22, receive, I pray thee, the law from his mouth, and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you shall be built up. You shall put away iniquity far from your tabernacles. Then shall you lay up gold as dust, and the gold of Ophir is the stones of the brooks. So, chapter 23. Job answered and said, even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say unto me. He's talking about, oh, if I can only talk to God face to face. Will he plead against me with his great power? No, but he would put strength in me. There the righteous might dispute with him, so should I be delivered forever from my judge. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he works, and I can't behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, and I can't see him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Job was extremely sincere, and he was very sincere about his status, his stature in the sight of God. Chapter 24, verse 1. Why, seeing things that are not hidden from the Almighty, do they that know him not see his days? Some remove the landmarks. They violently take away flocks and feed thereof. He's trying to answer what Eliphaz had said. They drive away the ass of the fatherless and take the widow's ox for a pledge. They turn the needy out of the way. The poor of the earth hide themselves together. Behold, as wild asses in the desert, they go forth to their work, rising betimes for a prey. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. Verse 7, they cause the naked to lodge without clothing, that they have no covering in the cold. They are wet with the showers of the mountains and embrace the rock for want of shelter. They pluck the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge of the poor. He's going through all of these horrible things that people do. And then finally, He says, verse 24, they are exalted for a little while, but are gone and brought low. They are taken out of the way as all other, and cut off as the top of the ears of corn. And if it be not so now, who will make me a liar and make my speech of no value? Then answered Bildad the Shuhite, he was the shortest man in the Bible, and said, I'm just kidding, dominion and fear are with him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number of his armies, and upon whom does not his light arise? How then can man be justified with God, or how can he be clean that is born of a woman? Behold, even to the moon, and it shines not, the stars that are pure are not pure in his sight. How much less man that is a worm, and the son of man, which is a worm? But Job answered and said, how have you helped him that is without power? How do you save the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled him that has no wisdom? And how have you plentifully declared the things it is? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from thee? And then he goes on and exalts God again about how dead things are formed beneath the waters. Hell is naked before him. He stretches out the north. He binds up the water into clouds. Verse 8, he holds back the face of his throne and spreads his cloud upon it, etc. Job continued in this parable, chapter 27, verse 1, and said, as God liveth, who has taken away my judgment, and the Almighty who has vexed my soul, all the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. I, in other words, said Job, am perfect. You can sit there for months and try to tell me what I'm guilty of, and I will never admit it. I will maintain my integrity. I'm absolutely flawless. I have done nothing wrong. I'm absolutely perfect. Satan the devil didn't know what in the world was wrong with Job, and neither did the people that sat around there and continually just accuse him of every conceivable thing. They just knew that this terrible tragedy that occurred to Job had to be punishment from God. Now, years ago, there was a young man in a worldwide pulpit. I knew the people involved very, very well. We were, I think that our very closest personal friends, when Shirley and I were very first married and in the work of God, when we came back out to Pasadena after our wedding right up here in Gladewater, were John and Audrey Hill. And John and Audrey got married shortly after we did, and they lived in a little apartment within walking distance of the Ambassador College campus. We had countless dinners and lunches together. John and I were in class together. We were very best friends. We studied Spanish together. We traveled together. Before I was ever ordained, John Hill and I had a three-day Pentecost meeting on the slopes of the Rocky Mountains up in Colorado on the St. Vrain River on the year 1953, even before I was ordained. Maybe 54, must have been 54. I was ordained in 55. But eventually, as the years went by, Audrey died of a terrible liver disease, and a young man stood up in a pulpit in the Worldwide Church over in Salt Lake City and told his congregation that Audrey's death was punishment upon John. Now, I've always wondered about that. I say wondered about it. I got rather enraged and very angry when I heard it, because it's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard anybody say. You know, if God wanted to punish Audrey, punish Audrey. Don't punish John by killing Audrey. But that's trying to make God into a murderer and taking away a life to afflict or to punish someone else. And so people are always looking for reasons, as did the people who came to Jesus Christ and told him about the man upon whom the Tower of Siloam had fell, or told him about the men whom Pilate had caught sacrificing and slaughtered them all. And you suppose, he said, that these men were sinners above all that dwell in Jerusalem. I tell you, no, but except you repent, you shall likewise perish. And I've explained it time and again. It doesn't mean in the same manner. It means that you will die a meaningless death, a useless death. Your life will have meant nothing, and your death will have marked no special milestones. You'll simply die as a result of time, chance, and circumstance. You will die eventually, and it will be just as if you had never been, except you repent. Because if you repent, then life goes on. If you don't, it's the end of the matter. People are always looking around to try to find out why someone is suffering, why someone is in trouble. God is going to get them, is what a lot of people think. And so that's what they thought of Job. Chapter 32, these three men ceased to answer Job, verse 1 of chapter 32 of Job, because he was righteous in his own eyes. Now, we come to the sin of self-righteousness. They continually argued again and again and again until you get to the end of the chapter, end of the book, really. Beginning in chapter 38, and I won't read it all, it's quite lengthy. The Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now your loins like a man, for I will demand of you an answer thou me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding." Now again and again and again, what did God do? He pointed out the creation. He pointed out weather, the earth, the sea, great creatures in it. Verse 12, "Have you commanded the morning since your days and caused the day spring to know his place?" Verse 16, "Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depth?" He said, verse 25, "Who has divided a water course for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness where is there, wherein there is no man?" Verse 35, "Can you send lightnings that they may go and say unto thee, here we are?" Verse 1 of chapter 39, "You know when the chamois or the adak, whatever, the wild goats that a rock bring forth, and can you mark when the hinds do calve?" It goes through all of these great creatures, including peacocks and ostriches, verse 13 and 14, which leaves her eggs in the earth and warms them in dust, and forgets that the foot may crush them or that the wild beast may break them. Chapter 40 and verse 6, "The Eternal answered unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, Gird up your loins now like a man, I will demand of you, and you declare unto me, will you disannul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be righteous?" How many people have you known in your life that tend to blame God for all their difficulties? Glenda can tell you that I've received any number of letters that have been passed on to me of people who had just given up on God. I got one the other day about tithing. I tithed and I tithed and I tithed and God didn't bless me. It's all God's fault. It has nothing to do with his attitude or what he did. I know nothing at all about the way he handled his money. Know nothing at all about the man's personality or his character. But it was just like he thought tithing, as I said recently in a sermon on tithing, was like going to Las Vegas and hitting the crap tables, and you throw the money out there and give it to God, and you ought to get more back than you sent in. But you get people who blame God, essentially, for the difficulties that they are in. We congratulate ourselves for our successes, and we tend to point the finger at God for our reversals. Verse 9, "Have you an arm like God, or can you thunder with a voice like him?" Chapter 40 and verse 15, "This may well be creatures that were on the earth at this time. Whether this is pre-flood or post-flood is debated. Some people think Job could be pronounced chop, because the J can be like a CH in some languages, and the B and the P can be interchangeable as well. And so it could have been that the Great Pyramid of Chop or Chops or Cheops, as some call it, could literally have been built by Job, because there's a great deal said in the book about the foundations of the earth and where were you when the foundations of the earth were laid. And some actually have associated Job. I don't know that that's true. It's just an interesting thought some people come up with. It's neither here nor there. And by the way, the pyramid inch is purely an invention of Mr. Davidson. It has nothing to do with reality. And so far as trying to figure prophecy by measurements in the pyramid, forget it. None of it ever worked. We met with Mr. Davidson one time in a solarium in a college, and he tried to explain all that, and I rejected it then and still do today, because most of all that they said was going to happen didn't. "Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eats grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force in the navel of his belly. He moves his tail like a cedar." You know, this is defining something you'll see in the books about some of the dinosaurs, isn't it? A huge, great, big tail about like a cedar log. "The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. His bones are as strong as pieces of brass." You ever been to the Museum of Natural Arts in Chicago, or the one out in Los Angeles, or some of the others, and seen an actual dinosaur all put together? Walked beneath it, looked up at the rib cage, the great leg bones about this big around. They're awesome. They're absolutely awesome. Just huge creatures. And there were thousands of different varieties of them, all the way from tiny little ones, all the way up to great big huge like the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and even bigger ones that they found in recent decades. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. Sure do the mountains bring him forth fruit, where all the food, where the beasts of the field play. He lies under the shady trees, in the covert of the reed and fens. The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinks up a river and hasteth not. He trusts that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He takes it with his eyes. His nose pierces through snares. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or his tongue with a cord which you let down? Can you put a hook in his nose or bore his jaw through with a thorn? So he's describing a great creature unknown to us today. Look a little later on in verse 14, 41, 14. Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal like an armor plate. One is so near to another, no air can come between them because they overlap. They're joined one to another. They stick together. They cannot be sundered. By his nasings, the light doth shine. That is his nasal, his nostril. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goes smoke, out of the seething pot, as of a cauldron. And as a great whale comes up, and the lungs are so superheated, and the water is so cold, and the air, he comes up and spouts and blows a great big cloud of steam. This may be something of a mammoth size that is unlike any creature that we know today. But you know, a great blue whale is long as a football field, so they're a lot bigger than an elephant, and the biggest creature on this earth today is a great blue whale. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth, and his neck remains strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. The flakes of his flesh are joined together. They're firm in themselves. They cannot be moved. His heart is firm as a stone. It goes on and on. He says in verse 27, he esteems iron as straw and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. In verse 31, he makes the deep to boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. And I think of a great, huge, amphibious creature that is lying in the fens of the marshes. It goes roaring out to sea, leaving a huge wake and all this roiled water behind him. Unlike any creatures that we know today, there have been a lot of speculations about what God is referring to here, but no one has really come up with a satisfactory explanation. He makes a path to shine after him, leaves a wake like a ship. One would think the deep to be hoary, boiled up because it is phosphorescent and white. Upon earth there is not his like who is made without fear. And so finally, after God shows Job, like on a beautiful tour of the universe, of this earth, and of all the great creatures upon it, Job answered the Eternal and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Men think they can know God. Men think they can know all about God. God says to us, surely you thought that I was altogether and one like yourself. But my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. As high as the heaven is above the earth are my thoughts than your thoughts. We don't think in the same way. Now you know and I know that the Chinese do not think like Americans. And Americans do not think in the same way as do Japanese. For example, lying in Japan is an art. You are expected to lie to one another. You lie in business, you lie in society, and the one who gets away with the most absolutely gorgeous, little, deft, wonderful lie and puts it over on the other one is to be congratulated. It is not looked down upon as being evil. The mores, the laws, the statutes, and so on of different nations are completely different. That's why this idea of Jimmy Carter's human rights, trying to foist that like a sort of a Baptist Southeastern theology upon nations all over the world, such as Indonesia and China and Japan and India, are just not going to work. Their minds don't work that way. They don't hold women in the same way that Americans and Western Europeans do. They don't look upon life and family life and all the values we talk about that come from a Judeo-Christian ethic in the same way that we do. Their minds are very different. I say that so you will understand that the most righteous man who ever lived could never approach to God. It will help you understand why Jesus made that enigmatic statement when the young nobleman, Matthew 19:17, came to him and said, "Good master, what good thing may I do that I may inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said, "Why callest thou me good?" We know that he was good in the sense that we mean it, and the young man meant it perhaps in that way. But as long as Jesus Christ was on the earth, in comparison with God, he refused to even allow the young man to call him good without chiding him a little bit about it. So we think we have God all figured out. We think we know his mind. We think we know his purpose and his plan. And we always try to say it was God's will. Every time I see people who are involved in some horrible tragedy, like, for example, I've recently seen some terrible crimes that were enacted on television and in the news media. There will be a kidnapping and a rape and a murder of a little girl. And the mother or someone will say, "I don't know why God, the Lord, allowed it, but we know that the Lord was there," and so on, and she's gone to be with the Lord, and we don't know why the Lord took her this early. And they've got God involved in the most rotten, hideous, satanic, filthy crimes and murder that you can imagine, and people will think God is involved. You know why Jesus Christ nearly got himself killed on the very first attempt at a public ministry at his own hometown of Nazareth? Because he said, you know, I've gone over it time and again, that in the days of Elisha, there were all kinds of people dying and starving to death in that terrible prolonged drought, but under none of them was sent Elisha, God's servant, except that one little widow lady, and she was a Gentile. And there were many lepers in the days when Elijah was there, and he was not sent to any but Naaman, a Syrian. So here's a Syrophoenician woman and a Syrian, and Jesus is saying to these people, God was not in it. God wasn't there. There was only one servant of God doing the work of God, and the established churches, meaning the synagogues, and all the religious types walking around in their splendiferous dresses with their phylacteries and tassels, all their garments, portraying themselves as great religious people close to God, and God didn't even know them. As Jesus said, the time will come when people will say, "Well, didn't we preach, and didn't we do this, and didn't we run an orphanage, and didn't we send packages of food abroad, and didn't we float Bibles across the end of the Iron Curtain on a balloon, and didn't we do mighty works?" And he will say, "Depart from me, I never knew who you were, never heard of you before." Just like I've never heard of a lot of those crazy so-called Holy Joes and sky pilots and weird charlatans, fakes, frauds, and dupes that are on television on a Sunday morning. Some of those guys are hard to take. And if you think God knows them, well, he can look down and see the woman with the pink wig and the mascara, I suppose, and know who they are. But so far as blessing them and being involved with them, "Oh, Lord, Lord, we praise thee. Bless thee, Lord." He's not listening. That doesn't go beyond the ceiling. He just is not involved with those people at all. Sometimes we make a mistake and we decide who is our human physical champion and who is closest to God. That is the enigma, that is the problem of a lot of people today. People will tell you, look you in the face, "I will never follow a man." And yet they will try desperately to do exactly that. There are all kinds of people sitting on a lot of fences right now. They used to be in worldwide, they've gone from one to another to another. We have people coming into the ICG now who have been around three or four different groups on a sort of a process of going there, getting disappointed, going somewhere else, getting disappointed, going somewhere else. Some go back from where they came. There's sort of musical chairs in the churches now with people deciding where they belong because they want to follow a man. But they need to follow Jesus Christ of Nazareth and stand on their own two feet. They need to understand what is the sovereignty of the individual. I want to talk about vanity for a minute, if you'll turn over to the book of Ecclesiastes. There is a vanity that comes with every conceivable part of life. There is a vanity of youth. How well do you remember that? When you were a young child, think now back to the very first day you can in school. Do you remember the very first day you ever toddled off to the first grade? I don't remember exactly that very first day. I remember very little about the first grade. I remember the name of my teacher, but not much else. I remember one or two of the little children that were there, but very, very little in my mind. But I do remember the way some of them acted. I do remember the little cliques that started. I remember which ones were the smart alecks, which ones were very much ahead of the other children, which ones were the braggadocios, which ones were the athletes. I remember which ones the little girls would always beat the little boys and a number of stars they got beside their name for some kind of academic excellence. I remember as I went through the grades when I came up to high school that there were all these cliques. I remember all of the fads. One day somebody showed up with a pair of saddle shoes, and within 2 or 3 weeks every girl in school and half of the boys were wearing saddle shoes. Then there was a time in an Oregon winter when the kid came to school with a green slicker on, made out of some kind of linoleum-like material, but he had pasted some Scotch tape with some initials on it. And everybody thought, oh man, that's cool. So we all went out and bought slickers and a roll of Scotch tape and put them on there. And one day, some kid showed up with a yo-yo. Before you know it, guys were going down the hallway playing with a yo-yo till the teachers had to outlaw yo-yos because they were interfering with traffic in the hallways, and they didn't want them to do that. And it was all these fads came and went. And then when I was in the Navy, a fad came along. Some of the guys were deciding to get their ears pierced. Now, this was really modern and new. And I was dating a girl up in Escondido, California, named Molly. Just had about 2 or 3 or 4 dates with her, and she tried to talk me into piercing my ear. She had the cork, the needle, the thread all ready. And I said, no, thanks, I'm not going to do it. I thought it looked pretty devilish. Some of these guys were wearing it on Liberty, and they had this one half moon, big old ear ring in their ear. I thought, man, looks just like a pirate. I thought, that looks pretty good. I went so far as getting these idiotic tattoos on my body. But at least I did not pierce my body. Now, the other day, some while ago now, the little girl's gone, I think, from Emerald Bay now, but out where I live, I wondered why this girl couldn't talk clearly. And she came up and I saw this thing kind of flashing, and I said, stick out your tongue. She stuck out her tongue, and there was a little bead of metal, steel or something, stainless steel, in the middle of her tongue. She had pierced her tongue. Where were we? We were out with some people. Was it in Seattle? My wife may remember. I don't know, but a girl came up, a waitress with a bare midriff, and I says, is that a ring in your navel? And sure enough, she had a ring right through her navel. I mean, that's a sensitive part of your body. Now, I won't even go into the rest of what they're doing with this, but I saw on TV just the other day, they showed this, and they were talking about it. There was a guy that had about 3 or 4 in his eyebrow, on his cheek, right beside his eye, and had these rings and metal right in his flesh. Now, God said you're not to make any piercings in your flesh and no cuttings in your flesh, but it's a fad. And it is, I need attention. I want people to look at me. My wife will grab my sleeve and say, honey, don't look. I'll say, why? They want me to look at them. There was a guy that went by with his hair plastered straight up like this. It was just as white or golden white as it could be. And long hair, but he had some kind of stickum on it, made it stick straight up. And I was almost mouth agape looking at him walk by. And Cheryl will tell me when we travel and go into these public places, you know, don't look. I said, well, why not? That's what they want me to do. That's why they're dressed that way. She said, well, you might get in trouble. I don't think so. I think they just, oh, man, he's looking at me. You know, I love people to stare at me, look at me. That's why they do that kind of thing. So I learned, but I forgot pretty much about it for a little while. And I thought, well, now we're mature, we won't have cliques, there won't be the cheerleaders, there won't be the great big statuesque athletic guys with the letters on, there won't be the real in crowd and the middle kind of anonymous crowd where I was somewhere, and then the down out crowd nobody will talk to. We won't have cliques, we won't have stratified society, there will not be class distinction once I'm out of high school. Oh yes, there was. Now, you ought to see at Emerald Bay, where I live. I won't talk a lot about that. Someday, 10 years from now, somebody might hear this tape and get mad at me. But there are cliques like you wouldn't believe. There are people who will sit with certain people, who will go out with certain people, who will fraternize and socialize, and will not speak to other people in grown-up, mature, retirement society. I found out there were cliques in the Navy, and it wasn't just because someone was of a rank above someone else. There were distinct class structures and cliques even in the Navy. Vanity of vanities, he says, you can believe it, verse 2, chapter 1, saith the preacher, and the word Ecclesiastes means the preacher. You'll recognize ecclesia in it. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Let's describe vanity for a minute. Vanity is not only a useless pursuit after wind, that is the ultimate meaning, but it's also pride. It is personal vanity and pride. That's why they call a piece of furniture a vanity. All women know exactly what that is. I'm going to buy me a new vanity. Well, you know immediately what that is. It's a place where a woman sits with all kinds of drawers, all kinds of mirrors, and takes 45 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, two, three. Must take that one woman I'm talking about 4 or 5 hours a day to get all that stuff on. And boy, I don't know if you know who I'm talking about. When I saw that, it was just ghastly. I thought the Baker family that went to jail, I thought, what's her name, is back, but with a new wig. What profit hath a man of all of his labor which he takes under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes. Now, here is a book which is written by a candidate for suicide. And it isn't until you get to the end of the book that you understand what he's really talking about in one sense, but it's a hopeless book in a sense. It goes through all these wonderful things he did, and when it's all over, nothing came of it. Now, it really does get to me when I think about a story my father told, and I think about this hopeless book, and I think about the man here who became a candidate for suicide because he says, whatever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. He built great institutions. He built arboretums and gardens. He built fountains and pools and lakes and ponds and balustrades. He built beautiful buildings. He built a fabulous throne. They were of ivory. They were of cinnamon. You know, cinnamon is a tree, you know that. They were of all kinds of cedars of Lebanon. They were of every rarefied and wonderful wood. And he had hundreds of singers and dancers. He said he gave his heart to folly. He followed music. He looked at dancing. He looked into all the arts. He tried it all. And when it was all over, he said, it was all a useless pursuit after wind. And what was I more than a fool? Because as one dies, so dies the other. Well, my dad is lying in his grave. Wish like everything he could come out of that grave and see what happened after he decided to reject his son in favor of another man whom he decided should be his successor. My father told the following story time and again. I heard it, I don't know how many times growing up, and he told it out of the pulpit. Some of you may have heard it. He went back to Des Moines many, many years later, long after I was even, I think, out of the Navy. And he and my mother made a trip back to their roots and tried to look up some old relatives and old friends. And my dad had written in the autobiography about his Uncle Frank and about this one banker that he knew. So he decided to go into one of the leading banks in Des Moines and ask about his old friend. And he walked in and went up to one of the vice presidents and asked, do you know so-and-so? And I've forgotten the name. No, they'd never heard of him. But I can ask someone else, and ask someone else. Finally, they found someone, and, oh, yes, Mr. So-and-so here, come on into my office. I remember that. So my dad sat down, and he asked about this gentleman. The gentleman had founded the bank. The gentleman had built that bank, started it out himself, and built it up to a big bank. Now it was a major institution. And so this vice president my dad was talking to said, yes, there was something in the newspaper about his death some years ago, and I think I may have saved it. So he went to his file, or got his secretary to go to the file, I forget, and they got the clipping. And my dad read from the Des Moines Register, whatever it is up there, the clipping, all yellowed with age, about the death of this man that he had known. And so he said, well, thank you very much. I'm sorry to see that. I didn't realize that that had occurred. So he's trying to give it back to the vice president. And the vice president said, oh, no, sir, if you were his friend, if you knew him, well, you go ahead and take it with you. We don't need it here. And so, well, thank you. And so my father put the clipping in his pocket. And he said, the last vestige of the man's name who had built the bank walked out of that door in my pocket. And he never forgot the lesson. Guess what has happened to the Worldwide Church of God and Ambassador College? Well, this book sort of gives me a little bit of a thought along those lines, because in verse 11 of chapter 2, he says, I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. Oh, by the way, do you want to behold madness? I did a little bit just the other night. I'm flipping around, you know, I just sit there. One of these days I'm going to get me a magazine that tells me what's on. I just go around the channels, and there are about 160 of them. You know, it gets a little tiresome. And every now and then, oh, there's something. History Channel, maybe. And I mean, here were some people in some kind of dance mode. It was obviously this kind of dance where they just stand in one spot and kind of wear a hole in the carpet and jig around and get their arms going every direction and their heads going everywhere. And I just had, you know, the sound is turned off when I'm going, right? Just turn it off. Now, if you want to watch something really stupid, you ought to look at the looks on these people's faces, men and women alike, your kind of dull look, and they're doing their shoulders and they're jigging around. Oh, man. And don't turn the music on because they got this beat, and you'll get into this beat and you see why they're doing what they're doing. But if you watch them without the beat, that is the dumbest looking thing you have ever seen in your life. And they are just in some kind of another world. Just the, oh man, look at me, don't I look wonderful, shaking my body. And of course, the way they do it, well, I won't go into that, but. All right. I turn myself to behold wisdom and madness, and you can today, if you'd like, and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which has already been done? All right. Good question. What can a man do that came after Solomon? What can Hilton do that he hasn't done? You know, what can any of these great multimillionaires do that they haven't already done? I've always said, as I've said before, about being thankful that you can only eat one New York cut steak at a time. You can only sleep in one bed at a time. You can only live one life at a time, and you can only drink one glass of water at a time. You can only just do one thing at a time like everybody else. The rest of it is all the beholding of the eyes and the vanity of life. I saw wisdom excelled folly as far as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and I myself perceive that one event happens to them all. Then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happens even to me. And why was I then more wise? But I said in my heart, this is also vanity. For there's no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. There have been many great men and women, many great exploits, many great achievements, and they're all gone and dead and buried, and you have never even heard of them. I love to read encyclopedias. I was reading the 11th edition, just picked up one, started reading, and I stumbled across Benjamin Franklin, so I read a lot about his life a little bit from the British point of view in 1911. But I like to read, and lately I've read almost all the way through the M and the P section of the World Book, because when I get to read, if I just want to read something casual, if I'm out of a book that I'm really interested in, I'll just read an encyclopedia. You'll come across the names of people, and they will be great painters, they'll be great artisans, or someone who invented an instrument, or someone in France, or I was reading a little bit even this morning about the French Revolution and some of the great battles fought in Italy, for example. And you read about these people and their great exploits, generals, and what they did. Never heard of them before. I never learned that in school. I never heard of these people. They didn't teach me any of that. They're forgotten. So these words ring so true. You know absolutely nothing about thousands of people who lived their lives caterwauling, bawling, straining, I mean fighting, scrambling over the next guy, pulling the rug out from under the ball, stabbing the next guy in the back, just doing everything, cutting corners, being a cheat, a liar, you know, evil people, amassing goods and money, building up some kind of a great ego trip for themselves, all kinds of homes and bank accounts and everything. Never heard of them. They're gone. And usually their lives are wretched. I've talked about that before, about the multimillionaires. By the way, would you like to take a look at Marilyn Monroe right now? I don't think so. I wouldn't. Been dead all these many years. But they still flash her face. And I always thought, just my personal opinion, I thought she had a terrible body, but that's just my opinion. But they flashed her face and her body and tried to make her into some kind of a great big sex queen. And I've often just thought about that. Utter vanity, the poor woman was wretchedly miserable, died a horrible death, and there's some question as to whether or not she died at her own hand. So you can go into these people's lives, you can see that people try to do all that there is to do. I look at I call it the morning worship hour. My wife and I get disgusted and turn it off. There's a segment, and it comes along both on CNN and the others, and it always seems to be timed the same, when they turn to Hollywood, and they've got some interview with some star. Now, a star, of course, is a great burning sun up in the heavens, but they call them stars. And they will invariably tell you how tough it is on them. It's tough to have a career and to keep up with their children, and they got these terrible trials. They go through their lives, and I think that is the most useless bit of nonsense. And you realize in the American frontier that actors and actresses were looked upon as charlatans and frauds, and a lot of times were even drummed out of town. But gradually now, people just adore and worship so-called Hollywood stars. Now, Solomon came to the place. He said in verse 16, there's no more remembrance of the fool than of the wise man. Therefore, verse 17, I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and a vexation of spirit, or, as it says, a pursuit after wind. Over and over again, he came back to that same point. Finally, at the very end of this book, he comes to the really summation of the matter. Verse 8 of the last chapter, chapter 12 of the book of Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, or words of delight, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And further, by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. Notice the word duty is added by the translators. It says duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments, for really this is the complete man, this is the whole of man, this is the purpose of man, it is why man is here on the earth in the first place. Anything short of that, fear of God and keeping his commandments, is vanity, because it ends in an empty pursuit after nothing. Now you cannot reach out and grab a handful of wind, but that is the essence of the word vanity. Grabbing a handful of wind. There's a vanity of age. You ever met people that say, I've had people that come up to me, just look wasted. I mean, absolutely look like they're on their last leg. I'm 66 years young, you know. No, they're not. They're 66 years old. There's nothing wrong with the word old. But I've had people tell me that I'm, you know, 79 years young, and so on. No, you're not. Forget that. Just be dignified, be thankful you're still alive, and say, I've made it this far, I'm already past what God allotted David, and so I'm living on borrowed time. Whatever, be happy. Don't worry about posturing about your age. Don't worry about it. My wife wants me to quit talking about how old I am. I'm gonna stop one of these days. I'm just glad I got here, that's all. Now, there is a vanity of spirituality. You ever met a real spiritual person? I've met several. I met a man, he came up to me one time, he was so spiritual, he said, you know, Garner Ted, when you were preaching that sermon about say to this mountain, be removed, and about faith, I was looking out at the mountains out there, looking out the window, and I knew that if I'd have said, be thou ripped up and depart into the sea, the mountain would have gone. I said, Rudy, next time you feel that way, you tell that mountain to get out there in that ocean. You know, that's hard to take that kind of stuff. I remember the guy with a soiled white jacket, and about a 2 days growth, whiskey on his voice, to a church party, called me over and wanted to talk to me, had his little string tie knotted wrong, greasy and everything. He says, Garner Ted, I've decided I'm called to the ministry. I said, well, first you better button up your fly, because his fly was open. And I just couldn't help it. I just told him that'd be one of the first things before you get into the ministry. Unbelievable. All right. There is a vanity. I hate to tell you this, but there is a vanity of the ministry. There's a vanity of the ministry. And boy, was I in it. When I was a young person and I was first ordained, I'd look around, I'd say, nobody's ordained here but me. I am a minister. And all of a sudden, I was somebody as opposed to just being anybody. And I would say to all the ministers, don't ever go through that cycle. Other people have been there before. I remember as a boy, I would stand there in the very front row with my parents at a little church up in Scrabble Hill, Oregon, and these ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day would sing in a song service. And that's when they got their exercise. Because they would sing, and as they would sing, they would rise up on their toes, and they'd just kind of bounce a little bit like this. And they'd sing again, and rise up on their toes, and they'd kind of bounce, and then they'd go back, and I'd watch these people bouncing, you know. And it was so funny. And then I remember a fellow, he tried to emulate my dad. My dad used to be a pretty powerful preacher. And he got to where he'd move around, and he would gesture. Well, my dad liked to carry loose change, and had in those days a little change pocket in the side pocket of a man's jacket. My dad got to preaching so hard one time up to Big Sandy, he's gesturing and his change came out and rolled all over the platform. It wasn't a few months later when this other gentleman was up there gesticulating and he just got, and I knew he had it all figured, you know, how to get it out there. He got his change rolling around the platform. He's the same guy who you knew he wasn't a bit vain when he came out to the Feast of Tabernacles in a nighttime service, walked up to the podium and he said, "May I say, good evening to you all." Could have just walked up and said, "Hi, folks." I bet some of you know exactly who that was, and you may have even been there. I think you were there. Some of you in this room were there. Now, is that vain or not, folks? Come on. Now, let's just be honest. That was just sticky with vanity. You know, just absolutely ridiculous. All right, I want to turn to a parable, and we'll try to quit this. I'm having kind of fun with it, but we'll quit it here pretty soon. Luke 18, 9 to 14. There's a beautiful song. If I'd have thought about this, Becky, I would have got the music and asked you to play it for me, but it's called The Publican. And you may remember that or not, but it's a beautiful song. Luke 18, 9 to 14. He spake this parable unto certain that trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee, and the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. And I like the fact that the Bible says that. He prayed with himself. "God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are." He probably said it, "God, I thank thee." You know, that's the way they talk. "That I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess." And the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes unto heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." "I tell you," said Jesus Christ, "this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For every one that exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted." I think that you can look wherever you want to in life, at athletes. Let me tell you something quickly that I take issue with. It's just something you've noticed as well as I. In many, many years past, when a wonderful baseball player, like maybe a Lou Gehrig or someone, or a great basketball player like Jerry West, or a great football player like maybe, I can't think of some names right now, but anyway, way, way back in the 30s and 40s. And when someone was really a champion at their sport, they would kind of hang their head, say, "Aw, shucks," walk off the field, kind of doff their hat, walk off the field. Now they get down on their knees and say, "Come on, give me some more applause," don't they? It's just unbelievable. "Look at me, I need more adulation. Adore me, worship me, aren't I great?" It is unbelievable. In your face kind of thing, and almost right across society. Now, I'm not picking on women, but I've got to go to the third chapter of the book of Isaiah, and God is not picking on women either, and none of you women are this way, thankfully. But if you want to watch some ladies like this, and it's not much of a fun thing to do, you can check the next time they have a style show on television. In the third chapter of the book of Isaiah, God says in verse 16, "Moreover, the Eternal says, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet." They wore little bells. You ever seen that? I remember when I was a boy growing up, they used to wear little bells on their feet, sometimes on their shoes. And at the skating rink, they put little bells on their skates. Therefore, the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Eternal will discover their secret parts. In that day, the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments around their feet and their calls. Now, this is old English language for all kinds of personal decorations, and I'm not positive what all of them meant. A call, it says in the margin, is networks, and their round tires like the moon, the chains, the bracelets and mufflers, the bonnets, the ornaments of the legs and headbands, the tablets and the earrings. Now they got nasal rings, navel rings, cheek rings, and rings put in places that you don't even want to talk about. The rings and nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, the mantles, wimples, and crisping pins, whatever they were. The glasses, the fine linen, the hoods, and the veils. That's an awful lot of paraphernalia for one gal to walk around in, isn't it? You almost bent over from the load you're carrying here. And it shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell, and I mean some of it can be so sweet, it'll make you sick. Now, you know, there are some, you sometimes will think that some ladies bathe in that stuff. But they have, you remember Gorgeous George, the wrestler? He had Chanel No. 5. And that at that time, was a, I think it still is a very expensive perfume. I've never smelled it, but they say that it's an expensive perfume. And he would spray it around the ring. Of course, he was kind of an obnoxious, outrageous character and made a lot of money doing that. But it shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell, there shall be stink. To me, a lot of it already is stink before it even gets to be a sweet smell. And instead of a girdle, a rent. Now, that is really bad. When you got a lady who's really big with a girdle with a big rip in it and a big bulge sticking out, that's bad, isn't it? And instead of well-set hair, baldness. And I better not talk because I'm not going to bend over too far one of these days or it's all going to fall out. When Mark was a little bitty boy, he was sitting there watching Mr. Leon Edinger, and Mr. Edinger was bald right down the top and had just little wisps of gray hair along the side. But when he would direct the chorale, and he would put his head back like that, it had about four wrinkles right here in the back of his head. And one time, Mark is sitting there, a little bitty old boy, and he whispered to his mom, he says, "What happened to Mr. Edinger's hair?" And his mother said, "Shh, Mark, it fell out." And Mark said, "All at once?" He may not remember that, but you hate to have it fall out all at once, I'll tell you that. Baldness, and instead of a stomacher, a girdling of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Thy men shall fall by the sword, and your mighty in the war, and her gates shall lament and mourn, and she being desolate shall sit upon the ground. You know, time and again I've thought about the tragedy that took place during World War II, and the times that I read of, and I've read so much of it, of the horrible mistreatment of people, and that if they could only known the truth of God, and if people could only have avoided those kinds of things. And when I think of what God offers us about a way of protection, a way of escape, not as a body, not to Petra, but he does absolutely tell you, pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Jesus Christ said, the ones that are closest to God, it's up to him to choose those who shall be his martyrs. But those who are not able to bear some of the terrible tribulation that is going to come, Jesus Christ promises to take care of them. They will not need to worry. He will never allow us to be tempted or tried above that which we are able to bear. He will never take us to or past the breaking point. He says so very, very clearly. So when Solomon finally came to the end of all of his reminiscences and all of his philosophies and all of his reasonings and talking about life and looking at everything there was to be enjoyed, and then finally found out that he hated life, because it seemed to be so unfair and useless, he said, let's hear the end of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, because that's the whole man. That makes you complete. That means you fulfill the very purpose for your life on this earth. And I think that it's wonderful to be among people who truly are humble. People who are brothers and sisters, who are not posturers. Do you know that in the wonderful little cocoon that I call the Intercontinental Church of God, in which I've been very blessed to dwell for these now nearly 3 years, it is to me almost like a little part of one of those movies I saw years ago when Cinderella was being helped by the little birds and the the animals and everything to clean the castle or the turret or the tower before her mother and evil sisters could get to her and prevent her from going to the ball. And here came a little buck, and he's in there, and the birds are flying with the laundry, and they're putting the laundry on the buck's horns, and he's drying them out, and they're just whistling and chirping in this wonderful little song. And it was a delightful environment. Now, I've been in environments not that many years ago where there was always a seething undercurrent. All around me were attitudes. All around me were looks. Listen not to every word that is spoken, lest you hear your servant curse thee, the Bible says. And I practiced that as well as I could. I remember one time going back in an old office way back on Broadway. We'd hired a new man, and I had written a booklet, and I picked up a copy of it. It was being proofread. And I had said, what is this thing about human nature that makes people react thus and such and so and so? He had penned in there, I don't know, what is it? Message came to me right then. Message came to me. That message proved out in later years. Back in Ambassador College, there were cliques. There were favorites. There was vanity. There was politics. Is there any clique? Are there any favorites? Are there politics in this church? I hope and pray not. Let's make sure we keep this church absolutely free from all that. No class distinction. I am a peer among equals. God has given me a gift. I'm exercising a gift as best I can, but I'm not better than anybody, and probably nowhere near as good as most of you.